Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our friend and guest, Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson. Susan Pierce Thompson, PhD, is an adjunct associate professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the University of Rochester and an expert in the psychology of eating. She is president of the Institute for Sustainable Weight Loss and author of the bestseller Bright Line Eating, The Science of Living Happy, Thin, and Free. Her breakthrough Bright Line Eating program utilizes cutting-edge research to explain how the brain blocks weight loss and to help participants release excess weight forever. In the last 2 years, Susan's work has helped people to release more than 150,000 pounds. The Food Revolution Network has been proud to partner with Susan on several major projects, and we have seen the results of her work firsthand. They are real, they are stunning, and they are making a world of difference. So now, Susan, we're so appreciative of your groundbreaking work and so excited for this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean. And Susan, what a pleasure, what a privilege to be in this conversation with you.
Oh, John, the privilege is all mine. Such a treat.
I want to begin by asking you a question that occurred to me when I was writing the foreword to your wonderful new book, Bright Line Eating. I'm someone who's been advocating for healthy food choices for a long time, and this has given me the great privilege of helping millions of people to improve their diets, and in many cases, to turn their health and their lives completely around. Over these many years, I've seen a great number of people become inspired to eat in a new way. Many of those people have experienced health outcomes beyond their wildest dreams. But there are others who have struggled to sustain food choices even when they knew they were in their own best interests. They had plenty of knowledge. They had plenty of willpower. They really wanted to make these changes, but they found themselves again and again succumbing to addictive pulls. The questions that I have for you, Susan, about this is, how is it that when it comes to food, so many people are unable to consistently act in their own best interests? Why is it that accomplished, caring, intelligent people are eating their way to obesity and to misery and even to premature death?
Oh, John, it's such a good question. It's kind of like the $64 million question, right? It's sort of the heart of the matter. And the reality is that different people's brains work differently when it comes to food. They respond fundamentally differently to food. And that's the crux of the issue right there.
And how, in what way are they different?
Basically, some brains wire really easily for addiction and some brains don't. And we've got pretty good research on this, you know, about the sort of spread in the population. It's in my book about, like, you know, 1/3 of the population has a brain that's highly susceptible to the pull of addictive food, 1/3 moderately susceptible, and 1/3 literally just not susceptible. Just not susceptible. Like, they can take ice cream or leave it alone. They'll eat, you know, a couple bites of a dessert and think, oh, it's a little too rich. It's a little too sweet. I'm kind of really full. I don't really want any of that. And other people's brains will absolutely respond differently to that. Their brains will say, not only do I need more of that, but you have no say in the matter. that's the crux of the issue. Some brains are really plastic in certain areas. In other words, they wire really quickly to various stimuli. And if you have a brain like that, it can be a huge evolutionary advantage. In this way, in this food environment, it turns out to be a profound disadvantage because you have a brain that's going to get hooked on the addictive foods. That's the basic issue. I have a quiz where people can figure out how susceptible they are. It's not hard to know once you've been living on this earth for a little while, which kind of brain you have.
Well, you've said that much earlier in your own life, you were on a merry-go-round with many of the most addictive substances on the planet.
But crystal meth and crack cocaine pretty much gets me into the club of people who've been addicts, I think.
I think it does. And yet you say, and this is my point, you say that nothing's harder to kick than the tyranny of food addiction.
And I'm not even, I'm not dressing that up. Like, that's real for me. Sugar and flour brought me to lower places, more desperate inner turmoil. than did crack cocaine or crystal meth, both of which I was addicted to for significant chunks of my life and ruined my life, essentially, as I dropped out of high school, you know, like completely devastated my life, and food was worse.
Well, we're starting here to enter into your personal journey. I'd like to hear more about that and how you've come to be where you are today.
I guess I wasn't really that young. I guess I was 20 when I realized I had a very addictable brain. But looking back, it was obvious from a very young age. I was probably hooked on sugar by the age of 5. You know, I was sneaking around to get marshmallows out of the cupboard when the grownups weren't looking. I was, you know, surrendering myself to agonizing errand runs in town and blistering heat, just because we'd go to a store that sold candy, you know, and I developed a weight problem. You know, it's funny, John, I was looking at pictures of myself just yesterday, pictures I hadn't ever seen before, pictures that my cousin shared with me. I was 8 years old in the pictures, and I have twin daughters who are 8 years old right now. So I know a little bit about what an 8-year-old girl should look like. I've got two of them in my house. And I looked at these pictures. I always thought that I became overweight when I was 11 or 12 years old, but I looked at these pictures and I was heavy. I wasn't obese. I wasn't, you know, super fat, but I was not a lean, right-sized kid. I was already fleshy at the age of 8. And I was, you know, sneaking around and eating raw cookie dough and stuff like that. And by the time I was 12, I was super concerned about my weight. And when I was 14 and I tried mushrooms for the first time, I lost 7 pounds in that one night doing mushrooms. I stepped on the scale after tripping all night and then sleeping all the next day, and I was 7 pounds lighter. And that started basically 6 years of my life where I did drugs to connect with people and to get the high and to have fun and push the boundaries, but also to keep my weight in check. And when I stopped doing drugs during that period of time, I would whack on 40 or 50 pounds in a shockingly short period of time.
When you describe losing weight by using psychoactive drugs, recreational drugs, I'm thinking of that there are healthy and unhealthy ways to lose weight. There's a lot of fad diets that work short term for some people, but they don't promote their long-term health. And often they don't even promote their long-term weight loss because there's a rebound effect.
Right.
What is the secret to healthy weight loss?
Right. And the tagline of Brightline Eating is happy, thin, and free. And I am always the first to say thin is not well. Like, I'm not about getting people thin if they're not going to be also happy and free, free from food obsession, free from the tyranny of the scale, free from, you know, powders and shakes and bars and all kinds of, you know, crappy manufactured, you know, foodstuffs, free from the rigmarole of needing to exercise 3 hours a day to burn off the pint of ice cream they ate last night and stuff like that. Free, you know, happy, thin, and free. I mean, I think the key really depends on which kind of brain you have, you know, how susceptible your brain is to our current food environment. But if you've got a brain that's, let's say, moderately to highly susceptible, then I think freedom actually comes from quite a bit of structure, more structure than people think. It comes from planning. It comes from quitting the addictive foods, not trying to engage with them in moderation. You know, it's sort of like if you were smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, you don't try to get healthy by going on the nicotine moderation program. You know, you pony up and you quit smoking. And for someone who's got a brain like mine, or it doesn't even have to be as bad as mine, but a brain that's more susceptible, there is actually a lot more health and freedom from what I call a bright line, a clear rule. I just don't eat sugar. I just don't, you know, I don't dance with that devil anymore. The one cookie experiment doesn't go well for me. So I think for a lot of people, a sane, balanced way to lose weight has to do with structure and it has to do with bright lines, which most people don't want to hear. But I think people are starting to be open to that message because nothing else is working for them.
Well, in bright line eating, as you mentioned, you don't eat any sugar. You also don't eat flour.
Yeah.
And flour obviously is a refined product. It's ground and processed from grains. Most people think of whole wheat flour as a whole grain product. It's easy to see why you would exclude white flour. It provides empty calories that are devoid of nutrients. What is it about even whole wheat flour that can make it problematic for people who are trying to lose weight?
Yeah, the issue with whole wheat flour is that the two systems in the brain that get really disrupted by, let's say sugar. Let's say that someone's on board with the idea that sugar should be eliminated, right? The two things in the brain that get really disrupted are the insulin system. So baseline insulin levels have risen, and that's blocking the hormone leptin, which is keeping people's brains from literally recognizing that it's time to stop eating. So people's brains show all the physiological markers of starvation, no matter how fat they are, when their insulin levels are too high and their brain can't see their leptin. So you can quit sugar and white flour, that's fine. You'll get a lot of benefit from that. But as you transition more of your calories over to whole grain flour products, you'll find that your insulin level is not coming down the way you want it to. Another issue is with the dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens, which is the hallmark of addiction. We see it the same in the obese brain as in the cocaine and heroin addicted brain. As a matter of fact, to my eye, the scans look worse in the obese brain. We have animal model studies that show that it's not ambiguous, which is the cause and effect there. It's the food that's causing the dopamine receptors to deplete. That's addiction right there. And in order to make the brain heal, in order to allow the brain to heal, what you've got to do is lay off the flood of dopamine. You got to lay off the gas on that, which means, you know, stopping smoking crack, stopping crystal meth, stopping eating sugar, and stopping eating flour. That's the issue, is the flood of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens. And that flour, it's not grain. It's just the flour. It's the grinding part that exponentially increases the surface area of each molecule that the digestive enzymes have access to. And those digestive enzymes go boom, they have a field day with those tiny particles, and the rush of glucose and fructose, depending on what you're eating, floods into the bloodstream, gives you a nice blood sugar rise. I mean, one study showed that the blood sugar rise from eating whole wheat bread is equivalent to the blood sugar rise in table sugar, higher in some people. You literally prick your finger after you eat a slice of whole wheat bread, and prick your finger and measure your blood glucose level after you did, a spoonful of table sugar, and see what happens. So that's the issue. It's the brain doesn't lie.
Susan, I'm remembering something you said a few minutes ago, that the crux of the issue is the reality that different people's brains work differently when it comes to food. So I think that for people who have a low susceptibility to food addiction, eating some whole wheat flour might be fine, while those who have greater susceptibility might be better off completely avoiding flour, like you're saying. I'm pretty low myself on the susceptibility scale. I've done your quiz. I know that. And I don't have any reactions to gluten. But I choose to eat only breads made from sprouted grains rather than from flour for the very reasons you just mentioned. When grains are pulverized into flour, their surface area expands dramatically and the conversion to sugar happens very quickly. So I stick to sprouted grain breads. There are a number of great ones made by Ezekiel and by Alvarado Street Bakeries, among others. I think people who are not highly susceptible to food addiction and who don't have difficulties with gluten can eat moderate amounts of whole wheat flour and be fine with it. But if someone has the kind of brain that makes them vulnerable to food addiction, as you, Susan, clearly do, and as many people do, then I could see that giving up white flour but not brown flour could lead to problems.
For me, when I gave up sugar and white flour but not brown flour, I suddenly found that whole wheat tortillas were my best friend, as was whole wheat pasta. And I never got happy, thin, and free. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. Bad expression, but yeah.
When you said suddenly these foods are your best friends, I think sometimes we have cravings for the very foods that, and they give us comfort, maybe because they placate the addiction temporarily. They're the very foods that really are doing us harm, but we have these cravings towards them. Is that your experience?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. And with a bright line for those foods, you can sort of find peace and, you know, rediscover all the other foods that are delicious but not addictive. Yeah.
When you were talking about sugar and how much sugar is in our foods, I was thinking about too. And one of the responses by the food industry has been to create, manufacture, and sell products that use non-caloric sweeteners. And these are touted as great aids to weight loss. They're not just in diet sodas. They're in a whole lot of foods and beverages that are marketed specifically to people who are wanting to lose weight. Now, many people avoid artificial sweeteners because of the potential link with cancer, because many of them are neurotoxins. Those concerns are valid. But above and beyond those concerns, it seems that replacing sugar with a non-caloric sweetener, even stevia, can actually increase our appetite for sweet foods later on and thus result in weight gain, not weight loss. I saw a study, Dr. Terry Davidson and his colleagues at Purdue University, it was with rats, and they found that rats eating saccharin-flavored yogurt gained almost 30% more weight than rats eating sugar-flavored yogurt. Now, that's rats. But Susan, can diet sodas actually make you gain weight?
Yeah, they can, John, and they keep your brain from healing. That dopamine downregulation that I was talking about, the dopamine rush actually is stimulated not by the glucose insulin system, but by the sweet taste buds on the tongue. So whatever it is that you're putting on your tongue that's tasting sweet is flooding the brain with dopamine. So not only does it make you fat, but it also keeps your brain from healing, which ultimately keeps your cravings alive. That's what keeps you from getting free. It keeps your cravings alive. There's other reasons not to eat artificial sweeteners. They disrupt the gut flora. So there's a really cool study a couple years ago that showed that that's one of the primary pathways that non-nutritive sweeteners, those artificial sweeteners, are bad for us, is that they cause some really bad, just bad gut flora. They kill off the good gut flora. They stimulate the bad gut flora.
That is an intense thing for a lot of people to confront. And there's been such a shift in the last 50 years. If you think about the availability of sweet foods 50,000 years ago, when we were evolving as human beings, or 500 years ago, or even 50 years ago, compared with today, I find the differences to be quite striking. 50,000 years ago, the sweetest foods available to most humans were berries, and the berry bushes were in season for what, a month or two a year? Now today, we have berries at the peak of ripeness available year-round, and berries are the foods that people tell you to eat when you're trying to quit sweets, you know?
Right. I mean, because almost everything else is sweeter.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're adding sugar to 80% of the calories in the supermarket. So yeah, berries are now the non-sweet foods, yeah.
Yeah, and they're full of nutrients, and I always advocate that people eat them. But 50 years ago, something happened. We had a massive change in U.S. farming subsidy policy. And this brought high fructose corn syrup onto the scene as a very inexpensive sweetener. And manufacturers began to add it to just about everything. It is now in just about every processed and packaged food in our supermarkets. Today, the average American eats nearly his or her own weight in added sugar every year. Quite frankly, Susan, under these circumstances, I wonder why we're not all morbidly obese.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very legitimate question, John. And that goes back to that not all brains respond the same. It's interesting how in this current environment, some brains are incredibly resilient against the pull of this junk that's all around us. And then some brains like mine are so pulled in. So the rewards are right there. There's a vending machine everywhere you turn. There's, you know, a movie theater snack bar. I mean, you can hardly, you know, hit a golf ball without, you know, in that radius hitting, you know, 5,000 places that want to sell you crappy food to eat. And most people are rushing out of the house in the morning, having no idea where they're going to get their food that day. You know, they just leave the house as if like good choices are greeting them where they go, you know? And it's amazing in that environment that some people's brains just fare okay. And those are the brains that orient toward the food itself, but not the cues that predict the sugar, flour, food rewards. The brains that orient toward the cues, it turns out, like mine, in rats, they call them sign trackers, brains that orient toward the signs that tell you that a hit is coming. Those are the brains that get into trouble. And evolutionarily, those were the smart brains. Those were the brains that were sensitive to the cues that predicted what was happening, like the cues that predicted that a rattlesnake was in the bush, the cues that predicted that that the storm was going to come and water the crops. The cues that predicted that, you know, we should head over that hill to get more food. But these days, the brains that are sensitive to those cues get enraptured by the cues and sucked toward them. There's actually research toward this. The pull is almost magnetic. We almost can't get out of it. And so the golden arches, the time of day, the emotion, the mood, all of those cues that have come to predict food rewards, whether it's, you know, tucking in your kids at night and all of a sudden it's time to eat something, or, you know, it's Friday night and so now you've got to go to a restaurant that's going to, you know, make you feel celebratory and everything. All of those cues that predict rewards are what sort of keep us trapped in their gravitational pull. And that's why for some of us, it's something that I don't think people have thought deeply about, but I talk about it in my book, and it's one of the reasons that some of us find it so hard to quit.
Yes, and our culture normalizes it, and we use sweets to celebrate. We use sweets to reward ourselves and each other. This is so embedded in our culture. When we change our eating, when we start to get healthier, it can be very threatening to some other people, even to ourselves.
Yeah.
And sometimes those people are very close to us. They could be acquaintances, they could be coworkers, they could be friends, they could be spouses, they could be, you know, members of our families. Sometimes they jab at us, or they just look askance at our efforts, or they mock us, or they criticize us, or in some ways they kind of sabotage our efforts. And Susan, how do we deal with that? How do we become happy, thin, and free if there are people close to us, people we are interdependent with, who are less than supportive, shall we say, of our healthy choices?
Ah, such a good question, John. And I think it does come down to these social interactions for most people. It's, you know, if you can't face the social reality of food embedded in the real world with your friends, with your family, with your colleagues, you'll never get there, right? Because food is part of the fabric of our relationships with people. And I think, you know, the short answer that I have to your question is you got to build your own support network. So I don't find people doing very well with this in isolation. You know, in Brightline Eating, we've got a boot camp where we have the most incredibly supportive online community that I could ever imagine. And people bring those comments to the community. I shared this with my sister yesterday, everybody, and guess what she said? And everybody's like, oh, sweetheart, I know she doesn't understand, but we understand. And, you know, you buck up and it's okay. And we're here for you. And, you know, maybe next time you could say this or, you know, whatever. People get the love of people who understand, because it is kind of still a world out there that doesn't understand. It really is. It's changing, but slowly. And I liken it to the change that's happened with cigarettes or alcohol over the last 50 years. When I was a kid, they were smoking on airplanes and in restaurants and everywhere. And now smoking is allowed, but you kind of have to go do it off by yourself, right? You're not allowed to do it in everybody's face. And I look forward to the day when food is like that. I mean, today, if you try to say no thank you to pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving, people will heckle you still today. Even if you have diabetes, you know, and you're trying to save your own life, people will say, come on, it's Thanksgiving. Can't you, you've been so good on your diet. You can, you know, and you could try to say, I don't eat sugar. It's a way of life for me. And, you know, they'll still heckle you. Whereas I think we've gotten over it for alcohol, where if somebody is holding up their hand on New Year's Eve as the champagne is being poured into the flute glasses and they say, no, thanks, I don't drink. I think in most places, we've gotten to the point where someone would respect that and go, oh, okay. And, you know, see if maybe they could get them some sparkling water or something to enjoy the toast. I look forward to the transition that I hope and pray is happening in our society, where, you know, that is one of the things that changes, is that we stop pressuring each other to eat unhealthy food.
You talk about in your online community, the importance of community support in general, and that in your online community, people get the love of people who understand. And that reminds me of our journey as a culture with alcohol and the 12-step work and AA, which are very much about people congregating with people who understand the journey. Now, your program draws on some of the principles of 12-step work, but it's not exactly the same. What have you found valuable in 12-step programs that you incorporate into Brightline Eating, and how is what you offer different?
such a good question. I come from a 12-step background. I got clean and sober when I was 20, and I have spent most of the last 22 and a half years just in, you know, really profoundly involved in 12-step programs, a variety of them. I've worked the 12 steps in 5 different programs. But I would say, for example, you know, the one day at a time approach, where we don't necessarily commit to bright lines forever. You know, we say, well, let's just commit for today, see how today goes. And if we like it, we can re-up tomorrow. That would be one example. I think the bright lines at all, I think just having the clarity of saying, look, we've known for a long time as a scientific community that sugar is addictive. I think we're coming to understand that flour is addictive. But in the scientific community, because people don't have a 12-step background, they haven't thought more deeply about it than that. Well, if it's addictive, then doesn't it mean that some people are going to really need to abstain in order to get freedom? And that notion of abstinence is something that our society just hasn't wrapped its head around yet. That, yeah, if that stuff's addictive, then abstinence, not for everybody, but for a lot of people, they're going to find, you know, no peace, no rest until they finally abstain. So I think that is a 12-step idea. And the support in general is very much akin to the sort of unconditional love and support in flaws, in imperfections. Just show up as you are. It's very 12-step. Now, there are a lot of differences. I mean, one of the biggest differences, I think, is that 12-step programs aren't and never claim to be scientifically based. They're just not. They're a folklore. They're an oral tradition. You know, you do what your sponsor did because they said so. And there's beauty in that, because with thousands of people jostling around in 12-step programs and sort of a Darwinian sort of effect happening, you end up kind of with what works. But in Bright Line Eating, we take some of that, we learn from what works, but we also learn from the science. So if the science shows a new thing tomorrow, we may very well update. So for example, right now in Bright Line Eating, I say don't drink smoothies, because that's my understanding of the current state of the science. If science shifts and it turns out, oh, certain kinds of smoothies don't cause a dopamine flood, don't mess with insulin levels, then it'd be like, oh, okay, let's try some smoothie consumption and see how it goes for people. And maybe we'll change our stance on that. So the commitment to science and to sharing the science of why it works is one big difference. No explicit God orientation is another big difference for people who don't want God or higher power mixed in with their program. We're open to notions of spirituality and divinity, but it's not woven into the program in the way it is in a 12-step program. You know, and then obviously, you know, Bright Line Eating is a company, right? 12-step programs are, you know, just a collection of individuals with no leaders and no, so it's just run entirely different, right? We have employees, we have payroll. So it's just, that's obviously different as well.
Well, you're trying to bring this into the 21st century and make it relevant to people's lives today, and even more than relevant, make it effective. Make it transformational for people's lives today. And I hear you saying again and again that one of the problems with refined foods, with sugar and flour, is that they release an unnatural flood of dopamine that hijacks the pleasure centers in the brain and causes cravings, bad cravings in unhealthy directions.
Yeah.
Susan, are we seriously underestimating the addictive power of refined foods?
Yeah, John, we really are. 70,000-80,000 people in America each year walk into a leg amputation. They know it's coming. They've got diabetes. And their doctor says, yeah, this is getting really bad. You're about to go blind. You're about to lose your leg. The next time I see you, we might be cutting off your leg. And you need to stop eating this and this and this. And they can't do it. They somehow, on a moment-to-moment, they show all the signs of the crack addict whose wife and little kids are about to leave if they smoke one more time, and they can't stay away. We are absolutely underestimating the addictive power of these foods. I mean, my colleague Mark Hyman says that sugar is 8 times more addictive than cocaine, and I'm not sure that he's wrong about that. I think that sounds about right from my experience. I mean, rats pre-injected with intravenous cocaine over and over and over again until they're addicted. They're quivering cocaine addicts, but you give them the option of sugar or another hit of cocaine, and they choose the sugar. It's just remarkable. We are grossly underestimating the addictive power of these foods. And we're giving them to our kids in their, you know, 6 months to 1 year span of life. 60% of American one-year-olds are eating candy every day. And the first food that almost all kids in America get is flour. Rice flour mixed in with rice cereal mixed in with the bottle or whatever is the, almost always the first food for kids. It's flour. So we give them sugar and flour, you know, right from birth. Most people in America have never gone a day in their lives since they were 6 months old without sugar and flour.
I have a friend who came to mind while you were describing the people with diabetes who are threatened with an amputation of a leg and still can't stop eating the foods that are driving, fueling the diabetes progression, and are unable to shift to the dietary changes that would reverse it, not just arrest it, but reverse it. And I have this friend who's quite overweight and has a lot of back problems as a result because the weight pulls on his back, and he's got and knee problems as a result. And he his doctor said, if you keep up what you're doing, in a year you will be in a wheelchair. So he's making his travel plans now. So he's going to do the traveling in the next year that he wants to do before he's in a wheelchair.
Now, I'm sorry to laugh.
It's a painful laugh. Yeah. It's a painful reality.
It's a painful, uncomfortable laugh.
Yeah, I understand.
It's like the alcoholic. The judge has told him, the next time I see you here, we're not going to talk. I'm throwing you in prison for a year the next time I see you, like drunk driving. You know, I've seen you now five times. And so would they just look at their calendar? Like, okay, I'm going. Like, what's going to happen to my kids, my job for a year? I better inform my boss, you know?
Right.
Oh, good Lord.
There's so many factors involved here, but a lot of us have used food to suppress difficult feelings, to create distance from painful experiences that we have not known a better way to cope with. And as a result of that, some of us are very afraid to change because we know how much we've stuffed life down, and we fear that if we were to be leaner and healthier, if we were to stop using food to numb out, we would have to face the feelings that we have avoided. Now, even with the greater aliveness and the greater vitality that comes with healthier eating, we fear that we wouldn't have the capacity to face those challenges. Susan, if we've been using food to suppress feelings for a long time, what is going to happen if we stop doing that?
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen. So you put down the food. And what happens is those feelings start to come up, usually not in an overwhelming flood. Usually they come up in sort of bite-sized chunks each day, but you have moments where you realize, oh, I would have been eating over this right here for sure. I would have been eating over this. And you get afforded opportunities to learn to do it differently. And it's really helpful to do it in community because, you know, what you turn to then is you send someone a text message. Hey, you know, my boss just said XYZ and, you know, the donuts in the break room are looking really good right now. And you hop on the phone with somebody and they talk you down. You get into the online support community and you post about it. You journal. If you're an introvert, we have a lot of introverts in Brightline Eating, obviously, you know, about half the population, funny enough, and they journal. You know, they pull out a journal or they go sit quietly in the bathroom or in a private room and they just take a few deep breaths and you learn to not respond to life by eating. And what happens is as the brain rewires, this is sort of a longer explanation to really substantiate what I'm about to say, but in my experience, about 80%, now that's not research-backed, that's just my sense, of the lion's share of someone's psychological issues, like the deep-seated issues, start to melt away as they just start to get clear and structured and have integrity around their food. That what was happening was betraying themselves with the food they were putting in their mouth and watching themselves do it was creating a smokescreen of psychological ill health where they came to believe that they didn't love themselves, they didn't trust themselves, they must hate themselves because of the way they were treating themselves with food. And when someone is shown how to pre-commit to what they're going to eat each day and then actually follow through one day at a time and eat only and exactly that, with no sugar and no flour, an abundance of vegetables and whole real foods, and they stick to it one day at a time, they build up a foundation of integrity with themselves. And within that climate and the supportive environment that I'm talking about, the community, those issues that we used to eat over can be faced finally, one at a time. A lot of it melts away. Like I said, a lot of it's a smokescreen, but there are real issues there. And we have a course called Bright Line Healing, which people take after the boot camp to come home to themselves. It's a coming home process, John. It's like you were right there all the time, but you were so distracted from the world and the food that you were using to react to the world that you lost yourself. And so what happens when someone stops that is they learn how to come home.
One of the things I think that keeps people from coming home is that most of us have inner saboteurs. I mean, you talked about betraying ourselves with the food we put in our mouths.
Yeah.
We have a lot of ways of betraying ourselves. We have voices in our heads that seem to want to undermine our best efforts, that tell us we're not good enough, we're unworthy, we don't deserve to enjoy life, we don't deserve to celebrate ourselves, that if we're going to celebrate, we should do it with sugar and ice cream and cake. And sometimes our inner saboteurs are actually very subtle and hard to recognize for what they actually are. So Susan, I guess I have two questions for you. How can we recognize our inner saboteurs for what they are? And how can we transform the energy they contain so that we aren't any longer controlled or defined by them?
Such a great question. In general, any voice in our head or impulse that is blocking growth, having us do unhealthy things, seeking the quick fix or the expedient but damaging, action is a saboteur. Saboteurs, by their very nature, stifle human growth. They want us to just take the easy, short, expedient way out. And they whisper at us to just kind of take that path. The highest self knows better. I think two things need to be done with the saboteur. The first, and this is kind of helpful at the beginning, like when someone's just doing bright line eating and they're in their first few days of withdrawal and the saboteur is really trying to talk them into putting a bunch of cream and sugar in their coffee or whatever it is, just this once, you deserve it, blah, blah, blah. I think just dealing with the saboteur really firmly, thanks for sharing. I'm not doing that today, that's not my food. And I'm going to get through this day, thank you very much, without sugar in my coffee. Sort of in the same way that as a parent, sometimes you find that with love, you need to smack back your kids a little bit. I don't mean hitting them. I mean, like, just sit down, be quiet now. That's not appropriate. Like as a parent, I have three kids. And sometimes you need to get really firm with them, time to stop now. And that kind of tone with a saboteur, not out of venom, but out of appropriate firmness, I think, is really helpful. But as you go further down the path, what's also helpful to notice is that behind the saboteur is something else. There are wounded parts back there. And those wounded parts might be really abused little kids, rebellious teenagers, middle schoolers yearning for some attention and some love and some comfort and safety, depending on what kind of environment you grew up in or how you've been treating yourself since you grew up. We have wounded parts to ourselves. And those wounded parts are often trying to get us to eat because it's comforting and it's numbing. And for a moment, it works. And what they want is for us to be safe and happy. So what you can do is try to kind of explore those wounded parts a little bit. I recommend doing this with some help, a professional who does some parts work, IFS, and there's lots of different ways of doing this. But learn about those parts, find out their stories, and then explore ways to talk with them and sort of have a mediated discussion where you let them know, look, we're not doing the food thing anymore. But how can we find the comfort anyway. Like there is another world of comfort out there. Let's find it together. Let's find the bubble bath and the heating pad and the cup of herbal tea. Let's find the good book and the fireplace. Let's find the walk with a friend. Let's find the comfort, because I want to give it to you and I want you to be safe and happy, but we're not doing the food thing anymore. So we're going to have to find a different way. Okay. And that kind of growth experience is a way around the saboteur, you know, to finally learn the inner landscape that's been driving the whole thing.
I hear you talking about finding comfort and finding safety, but instead of reaching to food, and particularly to unhealthy foods for that, reaching to the vast array of other options that when we are addicted to food, we don't know are there. We don't see them.
Right. Or yeah, we're just not taking advantage of them. Yeah, totally. There's so many other options. The voices in the head, John, are really important. I was thinking about your friend that you mentioned who's basically resigned himself to living in a wheelchair after this year. One of the things I write about in the preface to my book is how we don't have an obesity problem. I say we have an obesity mystery. It's just mysterious that this is happening around us. And one of the things that I think is most mysterious is that the population at large remains so veiled to this bizarre thing that's happening around us, which is that so many people want to get thin and can't. And it baffles me that people are failing so badly and not aware that it's weird that they can't do it. And the crux of the issue, I think, is what's happening with your friend, John, which is that as he makes choices, now I'm not going to pick on him. I'll just say in general, as we make choices to eat in a way that's clearly not in alignment with our highest good, right? I mean, this guy knows he's going to spend his life in a wheelchair and he's, you know, going to go get a burger and a fries and wash it down with a milkshake, right? As he makes that choice, what leads up to that is a brain that's spinning a story about it and whispering to him in his own voice in a way that he still thinks is him making a decision. And this is the issue, is that we've confused the voices in our head that are actually, neurologically speaking, a brain hijacked by sugar and flour and our current food environment. That hijacking actually causes an audible narrative in our head that manipulates us and convinces us to eat, and we mistake it for our own voice. And the way I like to introduce people to this idea is I ask people, like, I wish I had like a duffel bag with $100,000 in it, and I could do this with someone live in person, like $100,000 of $100 bills bundled up. Here you go. I will give this to you if you can hold your breath for 2 minutes. Here's the timer. Ready, set, go. And what I ask them to do is to listen to the voice in their head that convinces them to breathe before the 2 minutes are up. Because what will happen is there will be a voice, there will be a narrative that will spring up and it will sound like them. The brain is actually demanding the oxygen that it believes it needs to survive. But it convinces us to take a breath before the 2 minutes are up, even though we obviously want that $100,000 to be the easiest money we'd ever made, right? Just easy, just hold your breath for 2 minutes, but we can't do it. The brain will force us to breathe. And in that exact same way, but just over a longer time horizon of weeks and months as opposed to seconds, the brain is literally forcing us to eat. And it does it in that same way by manipulating our thinking. And I want people to learn what that manipulation sounds like so they can recognize it. It's not them. And that's why everybody's blind to what's happening, because people believe that they're choosing it. We're all complicit in it. Our brains are blocking us from losing weight.
Well, your point that the narrative in our head is that we identify with. We think it's our own voice. We think it's our heart, our soul, our own thinking. It's us. But it's actually something that we've internalized from the culture or something that is a byproduct of an addictive process. And it's leading us astray. You referred to the friend of mine who may end up in a wheelchair that I had mentioned. And you said, well, so he'll eat burger and fries. Actually, this fellow doesn't eat burger and fries. He eats more healthy than the norm in our culture. It's still not good enough. He's gone the direction he's going. He's very overweight. He's got all these problems. Those are real. But the narrative in his head says, I'm eating healthy. And when he looks at the people eating burgers and fries and milkshakes all day, he is eating healthier than they are, but he's obviously not eating healthy enough for his well-being, his optimum functioning, his highest potential, his ability to walk.
Mm-hmm. We're back to the whole wheat flour thing, right? He's probably eating organic black bean brownies and oat date bars. I mean, I'm just guessing, right? You can go into any health food store.
That would be more the direction, yeah.
You can go into any health food store and probably, you know, I wonder in a health food store, what percentage of the calories have added sugars to them? It would be pretty high. If you take added sugar or flour, it would probably be pretty high. I wouldn't smoke organic crack that was locally sourced, you know, and gluten-free.
They do sell organic Twinkies.
Right?
And I was talking to John Mackey, who is the founder and CEO of Whole Foods Markets, and he said 90% of what we sell in our stores is junk. Mm. He knows it, but that's where the profit margins are.
That's right.
That's where the revenue stream comes from. And he justifies it because that enables them, they have the profits then, to enable them to also sell healthy foods. It's a culture of disease. It's a culture of toxicity. And we've internalized it into our thinking, into our bodies, into our cells, into our relationships to food, into our relationships to our bodies in so many ways. You know, Susan, I'm thinking about how in the last 2 years, the Food Revolution Network has collaborated with you. And together we've put on a pair of 8-week courses. And between those two courses, we had about 5,600 participants, the vast majority of whom joined the program hoping to lose weight. And in 8 weeks, they combined to lose more than 90,000 pounds. When I first saw that number, 90,000 pounds lost in 8 weeks, I was just floored, and I was also filled with gratitude because I thought of the cases of diabetes that had been averted, of the heart attacks and cases of cancer that had been prevented, and I thought of all the people who now can be more present in their lives, who feel more confident in their bodies, who can show up more fully for the people they love. And Susan, I so appreciate your work. I appreciate your wisdom, your clarity, and your compassion, and how you help people to live the lives they truly want to live. It's a privilege to know you, to be your friend and colleague, to have your voice and wisdom as part of this summit. On behalf of Ocean and myself and everyone involved in the food revolution, I thank you for your ongoing wonderful work and, of course, for being with us today.
Thank you, John. Such a pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Susan Pierce-Thompson, president of the Institute for Sustainable Weight Loss and author of Bright Line Eating, The Science of Living Happy, Thin, and Free. Susan, food's an area in which the vast majority of people are consistently acting out of keeping with their own best interests. And it's really painful to contemplate how much self-hate and how much suffering is ensuing from addictive relationships with food. At the same time, it is so heartening and so inspiring to see the opportunity your work is opening for real food freedom. And when I see the depth and the power of your work and take in how many people I know whose lives have been personally transformed by it, frankly, I want to get it out as widely as possible. We want to thank you so much for your brilliant leadership, for your penetrating insights, and of course, for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you both so much. Really, really a pleasure.
Always. Yes.
I'm so touched to be a part of this again this year. It's such an honor.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.